Tereo Ererangi o Te Mānia. This episode was produced in Otatahi by Plains Media, with support from New Zealand On Air.
It's time for Bookends, sponsored by Scorpio Books. Kia ora koutou katoa, ngā mihi nui kia koutou o mō ngā wiki o te reo Māori. It's Bookends, and we're recording in Te Wiki o Te Reo Māori, although this won't go to air this week, but it's such an important celebration for Aotearoa, our beautiful reo. And so we might throw some reo in our interviews today, do you think, Maureen?
Well, I'm actually, I have already spoken to Scottish writer Liam McIlvaney, but he lives in Dunedin, Otipoti, so I can't remember if I threw anything in there or not. Possibly not.
We shall hear. And I'm interviewing the fabulous the author of the fabulous Puka Puka, The Secret Green. It's an eco-adventure set in the Ngāhere of Aotearoa, and it's written by Sonia Wilson, and really looking forward to that kōrero with her. And then you've also got...
Well, first of all, Liam McIlvaney is a crime writer, and I wanted to talk about the Nio Marsh Crime Awards coming up on the 25th of September, Thursday, the 25th of September. It's going to be at Tūranga and starts at 6 o'clock, and it's going to include a performance by the court jesters. I think they're going to solve a murder mystery for us.
Cool.
But then there's going to be the most extraordinary lineup of the finalists. This year, there's nonfiction and, along with fiction and best first book. So you can expect to see people like Charity Norman, Michael Bennett, Vanya Simon, and Marie Connolly from Akaroa with her best first book, and possibly Steve Brawnius is a finalist.
He enjoyed his last trip here so much with his sojourn out to Kaiapoi. Let's see where he graces us with his presence again.
So if you're a crime fiction fanatic, or non-fiction, crime book fanatic, please come to Tūranga, Otatahi, 6 o'clock, on Thursday, the 25th of September. And then we're ending with the ever effervescent Claudia from Scorpio, who's going to be telling us about all the events that they're hosting at the shop. And boy, they pack them in.
Yeah, fantastic. Great. Good lineup.
I've read that the sign of a good crime novel is if you can't give anything away about the plot. And The Good Father, Liam McIlvaney's, is one such novel. Liam, of course, has won a number of prizes for his work. He's won the Nio Marsh Award, and he's won the Bloody Scotland McIlvaney Prize, which was named after his famous father, William McIlvaney. He is the Stuart Professor of Scottish Studies at the University of Otago here, and has lived in Dunedin for a number of years yet. Liam, you've yet to write a book set in New Zealand. Is that a conscious thing, or is it just that your ideas and inspiration keeps coming from your homeland?
Yes, well, first of all, thanks very much for having me on, Maureen. Yes, you're right. I've lived in New Zealand for 17 years now, but all my books are set in the west of Scotland. I think that's just the place that my imagination returns to. I think it's, you know, that great concept of Tūranga Waewae, of a sort of standing place, a place where you feel at home, where you know how things work, you stand tall. Although I've lived in New Zealand for nearly two decades, my Tūranga Waewae remains the west of Scotland, and that's the place I love to return to in my imagination to write about. I mean, I have started, in my drawer I've got about 10,000 words of a novel set in Dunedin, so whether I'll return to that at some stage and finish it, I'm not sure.
Well, this particular story is so rooted in the place because you need, or the reader needs to feel that they know the place, and all the inhabitants in the place are so involved in the mystery, really, because every one of them, or not quite every one of them, but most of them could be complicit or not. So it does require a really strong sense of place and a sense that the writer knows what he's writing about.
It does, yes. So it's set in this little village of Fairlie, and I know we've got a Fairlie in the South Island of New Zealand, but this is the Fairlie outside a seaside town called Largs in the west of Scotland. And I mean, in one sense, I guess the novel could have been set anywhere. It's about, a sort of catastrophic event in an idyllic seaside community. So it could have been set in, I don't know, Monterey or Cornwall or wherever. But there's something about this particular community that I'm writing about that lends itself to this kind of narrative. So the premise of the story is that there's a couple, Gordon and Sarah Rutherford, who live this idyllic life in this very pleasant seaside community, and their little boy, Rory, who's 7, goes missing from the beach in front of their house, and they have to try and work out what's happened. But I like this community of Fairlie as the setting for that, because it feels like the kind of place where nothing can go wrong. It's a one-street village with the hills sheltering it from behind. You've got this narrow strip of what we would call firth, or a little strip of sea in front of it, and then the island of Cumbrae, the sort of sheltering bulk of Cumbrae in front of it. So it's this little bowl where you feel that all the bad stuff happens at the other end of the railway line in the big bad city of Glasgow, but you're completely safe here. And that's sort of reinforced by the fact that the houses on the seafront are behind this big sea wall, and they're villas that were built essentially by the Glasgow merchant class in the Edwardian period. So people like Tennant the Brewer came down and built their seaside homes here. And just when I was sort of wandering around, walking up and down the beach, you would look at these houses and think, you know, there you are behind your big sea wall and your big fancy mansion. You must think that you're bomb-proof and that nothing can go wrong. So, of course, being a crime writer, your second thought then is, how could I introduce an element of catastrophe to this idyllic scene?
Well, it is the worst possible catastrophe, really, and it happens immediately. You don't give us a really cruisy start to this book, Liam. We're immediately in, you know, this terrible search for the child that has just disappeared into thin air.
Yes, that's true. And I suppose partly what I was trying to do with this book was to try to give that traumatic event its real narrative gravity, its real narrative weight. You often see the disappearance of a child used as a plot point in crime dramas, whether it's in books or TV, and that we then sort of segue straight into an investigation that barrels towards its conclusion. And I wanted to see if you could look at what happens when the initial search is wound up, when the television cameras have packed up and gone home, when the news cycle has churned up something else, and the family is left to sort of pick up the pieces of their lives. Could you narrate that over quite a long period and maintain a sense of dramatic tension for the reader? So for the first half of the book, it covers a period of about 7 years after the loss of Rory, their 7-year-old child. And the challenge, I suppose, I set myself there was, it's quite an unusual way to approach a thriller. Usually a thriller is very compact. You've got, you know, 3 days or whatever. You've got to catch the killer before he strikes again. You've got to defuse the bomb before it goes off. I know very often thrillers, in terms of novels, are often structurally divided into days, you know, day one, day two, day three. So in this case, it would be day, you know, I don't know, 562 or whatever it is. So it was to see if I could do that and sort of maintain a sense of dread in the heart of the reader as they go through the book. So and then about halfway through the book, something rather dramatic happens that I can't talk about because it would be a spoiler. But thereafter, it's sort of the novel speeds up back again to the normal pace of a thriller.
And it's not around any particular police person or detective or a, you know, there are police in it. It's all told in the first person from Gordon Rutherford, the father's point of view. So that's another difficult thing to maintain.
Yes, well, I found that actually a breath of fresh air, Maureen, to some extent, because with the previous two books, they had been centred around a police detective, and in fact, a police detective in 1960s and 1970s Glasgow. So there was a lot of research to do to try to think my way into that character, Duncan McCormick's position, and sort of get the police procedures right and so on. In this case, my protagonist, Gordon Rutherford, is a middle-aged Scottish literature academic doing a job that I've done for 28 years, and so should hopefully know a couple of things about. So that element of it was a bit of a warm bath, you know, just being able to write about my own experience and not have to rely on research and contacting ex-cops to find out the details of the police procedures. And I also did pretty much no research into missing children or investigations into missing children. I deliberately stayed away from that, and I just wanted, the research was all inward. Mm. How would you feel if this happened to you? You know, if your child went missing, how would that affect your relationships with other people in your family? How would it affect your view of the world? How would it impinge upon your standing in this small community? All of those things. And that was all just drawn from within. That was just looking within for the research. So again, I enjoyed that because when you're writing police procedurals, and particularly when you're writing police procedurals set in, you know, Glasgow in the 1960s or 70s, there's an awful lot of research that you have to do. And I really enjoyed kind of, research can be a little bit of a crutch. You know, you do all your research and then you build your narrative around it. I liked the nakedness of this book, if I can put it like that, that this was just, you know, my own emotions as to how I would feel if I was in Gordon Rutherford's situation, and I just wrote it straight off from there.
Yeah, I'm interested in that because, you know, his wife, Sarah, you have to somehow give us access to how she might be feeling without... and how do you do that properly in a way that doesn't sort of jump into her head? But
yeah, I mean, there might have been a case for splitting the narrative and giving some of the narrative from Sarah's point of view, and Sarah's point of view is a deeply interesting one, it seems to me. But at the same time, I wanted to keep the focus on Gordon Rutherford, just to funnel him down this dark tunnel and sort of keep the pressure on him. It's Gordon who was responsible, notionally, for Rory when Rory went missing. So it's Gordon's responsibility, he feels, to try to redeem the situation. And it takes him into some fairly dark places. So I wanted to sort of keep the camera focused quite tightly on Gordon, just to increase that sense of one man being funneled into a very dark place.
And as I said at the beginning, it's a story you can't disclose any of the plot for fear of wrecking it for other.
Yeah, I mean, I sort of realised that as I was touring around Scotland. I did 22 events in July and into August. And yes, that became very quickly apparent that it was a book that it was slightly difficult to talk about for that very reason. So in a way, you've just got to take it on trust. You know, trust me, there's a big dramatic event that happens about halfway through the book, because you can't we can't actually talk about that, or it would give away the whole plot.
Is it ever a problem for you when you are doing interviews or you're speaking to a group of people, some of whom may have read the book? Is it ever a problem if somebody unwittingly or wittingly
By and large, the book was fairly well reviewed, and there were quite a number of reviews, and most of the reviewers avoided any spoilers. But I think it was the Times, the Sunday Times reviewer, just blithely sort of blundered straight in and gave away the silver, as it were. So that was slightly annoying, but. But by and large, when you're doing events, it's quite easy to sort of talk around that and avoid spoilers. And people who are planning to read the book obviously don't want to have they want to approach it fresh and find out those dramatic happenings on their own.
Yes, they have to trust you, don't they? As you say, take it on trust. And I think you've built readers' trust because of their experience with reading.
Yeah. And it's partly, earlier I think, books. In a way you could say it's quite a long period in terms of the number of years the narrative covers, and that we're dealing with about half the book before this big dramatic happening. But partly I wanted to introduce readers to these characters, to Gordon and Sarah, and give them a real granular sense of what these characters are going through and how it's affected them. And with the hope that when you've been immersed in their predicament, you're more likely to go with them when they find themselves contemplating actions that they could never have imagined they would be contemplating at the start of the story. It's partly that, the writer Saul Stein has a great line where he says, you need to know the people in the car before the car crashes. Mm. And it was partly that. Let's get to know these people before we get into really dark territory.
Well, I think, nothing seems to have happened, so to speak, by about halfway through the book, you know that the second half, there's got to be a lot going on in there because you've got to this point and you know that somehow you're going to keep pulling us along and things are going to
absolutely
unleash.
I think most of the readers have been quite blindsided by what happens and didn't see it coming. And that
no,
was one of the things.
No.
Was,
well, I'm one of them, absolutely. And at that point, there's two reactions, isn't it? One is to put the book down and think, gosh, I'm going to have to gird my loins for the next bit. Or you just think, oh, my gosh, I can't put this book down because I really need to know what happened. How did you feel when you finished this book because of your immersion into Gordon and his interior?
Yeah, it was quite intense. I wrote it quite quickly by my standards. I'm not the fastest crime writer. So it was an idea that just sort of seized hold of me. I had actually started... another Duncan McCormick book. I think I was about 10,000 words into it when the idea for The Good Father came to me and just really knocked on the door and demanded to be written. And so I put aside the novel I was working on and I wrote this in a sort of burst of activity, I suppose. And there is that, it is a very immersive, it's a bit like a diving bell, you go down into the story and sometimes it's only when you surface and look back at what you've written, you sort of surprise yourself sometimes by how dark it is and, the sort of emotions that are at play. But you don't really feel that at the time when you're immersed in the story. There's something about just the narrative sort of propels you on and you're just concerned with taking the narrative to its logical conclusion. So that insulates you, I think, a little bit from some of the raw emotions that are in play when you're writing it. But yes, when you kind of come up from the diving bell and then sort of look back, it can be quite a surprising experience.
Yes, that's right. It's almost like you need the diving bell where you need to sort of re-establish yourself, or there's special words for what you do when you come out of those, isn't it?
Decompressing, yes.
Decompressing, that's right, before you enter back into the world.
That's
well,
right.
It is a remarkable book, and right. I think we've got through our discussion without letting on, but I hope intriguing people so that they will go out and find it. So thank you, Liam. It's been a joy talking to you about the book.
Thanks so much, Maureen. Thanks for having me on.
The book is called The Good Father. It's by Liam McIlvaney and it's published by Allen & Unwin.
You're listening to Bookends on Plains Media, broadcasting on 96.9 FM, streaming live and available as a podcast on plains.org.nz.
Sonia Wilson is an ex-journo, mum, a kaitohi, and the founder and executive director of Kiwi Christmas Books, which gifts to families in need across Aotearoa every Christmas. She joins us on our show this morning to discuss the second Puka Puka in her eco-adventure Spark series for middle readers, age 7 to 13-ish, The Secret Green. It's a fantastic book, and I've been looking forward to our chat about it, but I think we'll find so much else to kōrero about too, Sonia. Tēnā koe. Welcome to Bookends.
Morena, thank you so much for having me.
It's a real pleasure. I read in a spin-off interview that you described Spark Hunter as the novel you wrote while you learned how to write a novel, the book that almost buried you, in fact. Well, we're very glad that you survived, and you sure did figure out how to write. The Secret Green is such a great follow-up. Did it come any easier?
Thank you. That's very kind of you to say. No, it didn't really, and that was my great misconception, I think, that I assumed that the second book would be so much easier. But I think it's a matter of the first time round, I didn't know what I didn't know, and this time I knew what I didn't know, you know, so the expectations on yourself are a lot higher. You know, I had a much better understanding of what good writing was and what a good story was. So, so I think there was a lot of pressure, mainly just, you know, from myself for the second book. And it wasn't, you know, it wasn't much easier. I mean, I knew how to write a bit better by then, but the process of dragging that story out of yourself and turning it into something that's, that hopefully gives your readers this sense of wonder and amazement, but also, you know, is just a really good, fast-paced story for them as well. You know, it's not as easy as it seems, and stories never arrive fully formed, obviously. Characters never arrive fully formed. And although you can have what seems to be the most wonderful idea in your head for a work of great genius, it never quite comes out on the page like that. Certainly not the first time round, and often not the fifth or sixth time round either.
Well, it is a beautiful, well crafted puka puka for this for that, and in particular with that age group in mind. Although I loved reading it myself, and I think the best children's literature engages the adult readers as well. So, congratulations! Because it's a follow up, I don't think it's a plot spoiler to ask you to tell us about the supernatural characters in your book, the Sparks. Could you describe them for listeners and maybe say what cultural traditions you drew on for that concept?
Sure. So the Sparks are, like you say, sort of supernatural forest creatures that live in Fiordland. And I suppose they are a bit like fairies, but they don't like to be called fairies. And they are, you know, they're very much of New Zealand. They're indigenous fairies. And at the start of the process, when I first started writing Spark Hunter, and I had this idea for these creatures that lived in the forest, you know, I figured out after some time that they couldn't be just a sort of rehash of a traditional English fairy, because if there were creatures hiding in the New Zealand forest for all this time, they wouldn't be like English fairies. They would be of this place. So I had to, you know, put a bit of work into discovering what of this place means. And of course, because they've been there for so long, they have a history that's longer than humanity's in New Zealand. So, you know, that my forest creatures, the sparks, they can speak English, but they also speak reo Māori as well, because that was the first of the languages that they learnt when humans first came to New Zealand. They speak a particular form of reo Māori, a kaitahu dialect, which your listeners hopefully might be familiar with. In Christchurch, they speak a sort of Victorian Scottish version of English, because that's what the vast majority of Pākehā explorers were speaking like when they first came through those forests as well. They're little creatures. They have hidden away in the forest for many years. They have wings, and each one is based on a kinship with a particular indigenous species of flora or fauna. So we've got moss sparks and rimu sparks and fantail sparks and tui sparks, and each of the sparks take on a bit of personality from their particular flora or fauna.
Including mosquito sparks.
Yeah, so I mean, it's set in Fiordland, so you can't not have a sandfly spark. Yeah, so the sandfly spark is named Lance, and he is very particular in his movements and the way he speaks. I've got a soft spot for Lance. He cracks me up a bit. So Lance wasn't in the first book, but he is in the second book, because I thought it was very remiss of me not to have included a sandfly spark. And anyone who's gone over into the depths of Fiordland will know sandflies well, and that you can exist in that place without being aware of those creatures. Yeah,
exactly. So kia ora for that. They are delightful, kind of, I suppose, the essence. They express some of the essence of our indigenous flora and fauna. So, and they do it in a really engaging way. Your heroine, Nisa, and her mates get to live a pretty grounded life, right? They're surrounded by nature, and they have kind of indigenous knowledge and values well respected within their communities. And it's a pretty beautiful life that they live, regardless of this adventure that they're taken on and that she's taken on. You grew up in Muruhiku, right? Tell us about your childhood. Was it like that? Was it like Nisa and her mates? And perhaps where your passion for our environment comes from?
Sure. Yeah, I mean, the story came about because of my childhood, really. And it wasn't, my childhood wasn't anything particularly special. In fact, it was, you know, I found it at the time very boring, you know, very boring and normal. So, you know, I grew up in a working class house in Invercargill, and with a dad who was into boats and fishing, which was very handy. So it meant that we spent our summer holidays, we certainly couldn't afford to go overseas or to do any, you know, what I would have considered exciting holidays back then. But what we did get to do was go up to Manapouri or Te Anau and camp at the camping grounds up there for our summer holidays. And then we would get out on the lakes and go tramping through the bush. And, you know, mum and dad were relatively loose in that they were completely fine with us disappearing for hours at a time. We even did some overnight tramps when we were kids into huts and stuff, not that old, and just had a great time. I certainly, my childhood certainly wasn't as rugged as Nissa's. So her family's a family of hunters, and they go into proper fieldland, you know, to go hunting for deer. So I never did that as a kid, you know, shot a few possums on a friend's or family's farm was about the most that I got. And I had to sort of keep going back to my dad and brother-in-law and asking them about rifles and shotguns and what caliber bullets people would use for deer and all that sort of thing, because I didn't, you know, I don't naturally know that stuff. So Nissa's childhood, I guess, is an extension of mine, and likewise, she is an extension of me, in that obviously her the base plot line, in that she goes away with her family to these places, and then she goes on school camp to Deep Cove, which is what I did in my Form 2 year or Year 8 year as well. But then everything else is you know, completely made up. Nissa is much more capable than I ever was in the bush, or am currently. And likewise with Tama and her dad and stuff as well. So
I love how capable you make her, and it's a fabulous adventure spirit to give children. And girls that capability. So yeah, that was obviously important to you in creating her character.
Yeah, I mean, well, you know, why should girls not be just as capable as boys in those situations? You know, there's she's got her friend in the story, Tama, who goes with her as well, and who's a much bigger part in the second book, because he goes back into the forest with her. He's a bit more sort of on the periphery in the first book, but you know, there are so many capable young women, particularly in Southland, actually, you know, where life is lived a bit closer to the land down there than what it is obviously in places like Auckland, where I live now. And you know, there's no reason why a 12-year-old girl can't pick up a rifle and shoot a deer in a safe way, in the same way that a 12-year-old boy can. Mm. And in fact, these days, lots of girls are taught those same skills, taught how to fish, you know, catch and gutter fish or thread a fishing line or whatever else. And also, I think just in terms of giving children agency in general within that story, you know, that is, I think that's just really important for kids to read. You know, part of it is about, I like how you described the book as an eco-adventure and an eco-fantasy, and you know, there are very strong messages in there about what we can do to protect our environment. And part of it is giving kids hope and showing them that they can do something. And it's not like that's completely outside the realms of possibility, what happens with Nissa and what she is able to achieve in that second book. You know, why not? That is something that could happen, and we can't, you know, obviously the world faces seemingly overwhelming problems at the moment, climate change just being one of them. And I really feel for young kids these days, because it, much more so than when I was a child, they have a much bigger sense of the weight of the world on their shoulders. So this is a way to kind of go, look, you can make a difference as one person. You can help protect really important things like these huge native forests in this country that are our lungs and our lifeblood and everything else. And you can actually do that. So it's really important in these stories to give the kids agency. That's what they want to read about. They don't, you know, they don't want to read about the adults making decisions for them, because they get enough of that in real life, you know.
Kia ora. I think that you've answered a lot of the second question, so this next question, but I think it's worth dwelling on. There's a hell of a lot of grief for our earth and its creatures in this Puka Puka, Sonia, isn't there? There's a real current of grief that kind of drives the tension in a lot of ways and the urgency of the adventure plot. So there's a lot of depth there, and you give Nissa and Tama a lot of weight to carry, as your hero and heroine, but you also keep their story light and hopeful, and they do have power, which they exercise with their mates. It's highly entertaining, and it's beautifully woven, all of those pieces together. You've already talked a bit about what you want young readers to get out of the book. I guess, you know, a chance to evolve that a little bit. You've got children of your own. What ages are they? And what do you hope for young people in general, not just what they want to get out of the book, but what's your hope for the young people of Aotearoa and of our earth today?
Well, thank you for saying such nice things about the book, first of all. That's, you know, what you've said is exactly what I hoped the reader response would be. Yeah, I've got two boys who are 14 and 11. And so I meet a lot of kids these days, both through my own kids and because I do a lot of school talks. I often do some creative writing teaching through the university and stuff. So I sort of meet, you know, primary and intermediate kids, but also older teenagers and university students as well. And honestly, I am, you know, the kids are okay. You know, I'm constantly impressed by how much smarter, how much more empathetic, how much more understanding that kids have these days that I did not at the same age. And I'm really, really impressed with them. I honestly am. And so I think that as much as, you know, if the more agency and the more inspiration we can give to them, the better. You know, I wrote a piece in the spin-off a few weeks ago about how I think that wonder can save the world, and that's the gist of my writing. And just, and what I meant by that is sort of noticing the small things in life and getting joy out of noticing steam rising from a piece of moss and that sort of thing. And that, you know, in the face of all these sort of overwhelming problems we have, that if we can learn to fall in love with the world again, then we're more inclined to want to save it and do something with it and you know, take action. And I think that our kids, you know, I'm too old to save the world. Like I said in that article, you know, I'm 46 now and my knees hurt. But I have great faith in the rangatahi around this country that they certainly can, and that they seem to have a much more clear-eyed view of the world in general than I ever did. I have great hope. Yeah.
Kia ora. That's wonderful. You also, as well as gifting us wonder in your books, you have your charity, Kiwi Christmas Books. Can you just quickly give our listeners a little bit of a view on that and how they might want to contribute to Kiwi Christmas Books?
Sure. So, yeah, Kiwi Christmas Books is a charity. We collect donations of brand new books and we gift them to families who can't afford to buy Christmas presents for their kids or who struggle to access books in general. So although we've got Christmas in our name and we use that at the end of the year because it's a great way to get people, you know, when they're already buying books for Christmas presents for their own families to donate to us at the same time. We also give books out throughout the year. So through a variety of charities. So we get books into prisons, we get books into women's refuges, we give them out through the city missions, through the hospitals, all around the country. So, yeah, we have a website, kiwichristmasbooks.org.nz, and it's got a whole list of, I think we're in about 38 different towns and cities now around the country. So I run it from Auckland and have some friends and family who help me out around the country. So picking up the donations in Invercargill and taking them to a local charity in Invercargill or same in Dunedin or in Christchurch. I think we've got 4 or 5 bookshops on the go in Christchurch who collect donations for us across November and December, and then they get dispersed or delivered to local charities who work on the ground with whānau in need.
It's very cool. Yeah, it is. It's very cool. And we love books and we love our planet. And so we love you, Sonia. And here's the really tough question. We had Alan Rikers from Forest and Bird on as they launched Te Manu Rongonui o Te Tau this year. So that's the Bird of the Year comp. Uh-huh. Have you chosen his books of Kiwi Christmas books chosen who they're going to vote for? And Bird of the Year.
No, that might require a substantive board meeting to decide decide what to do. I struggle with this question because kids often ask me as well, like what my favourite bird is, given that there's so many birds in my books, and I have a different answer
every time. You get five this year, so our people will reach out to Kiwi Christmas Books. We'll see if we can do a voting block. So our people will talk to your people. Sonia, ngā mihi for joining us today. The book is The Secret Green by Sonia Wilson. It's published by Alan and Unwin, and get your copy at your local bookstore.
You're listening to Bookends on Plains Media, broadcasting on 96.9 FM, streaming live and available as a podcast on plains.org.nz.
This is going to be a bit like speed dating because Claudia from Scorpio has a lot of things to get through. So I'm going to shut up and she is going to talk at the fastest speed she possibly can.
As quick as I can while still giving due diligence and honouring our authors for Scorpio books for the next month or two. Well, let me tell you, spring's going to be busy. And there's something for everybody, which is really nice. It just goes to show the breadth of local talent in publishing, really. On the 24th of September, we are going to be launching The Edge of Light 2, The Miracle by A.M. Dixon, most often known as Mel Dixon. You probably would have heard of her. She teaches around town.
I know her very well.
A friend to the show, a friend to writers throughout the city. The Miracle is the second in a trilogy of YA novels. We launched the first one last year, New Dawning, which also received a Storylines Notable Young Adult Fiction Award. So we're looking forward to getting into this one. And it's set in a kind of dystopian New Zealand-esque environment.
I would say anybody who lives around the Littleton Harbour will recognise it.
Indeed. And then the next morning, 10 a.m, bit of a special offering for Scorpio Books for the school holidays. We are hosting a high tea with Jess Ehrlich. Jess Ehrlich, you may have heard of through social media. She shot to fame, went viral with her poems about motherhood and raising kids. She's releasing a new. It's a gift book. We describe them. They're very pretty and they've got illustrations. This one's called May You Always Know, a poem of hopes and dreams, and they're designed to be sort of read with your kids. It's a very lovely story and it's very inspiring and very beautifully made. So we're going to be hosting a high tea to celebrate Jess. She will be she's going to be like on the podium answering questions, talking about her books. She also writes a lot of children's books, picture flats with lots of illustrations. There'll be a kindness station for young people to make little things and get involved, and also lots of yummy little bits of food. So that'll be a new one for us. We're not really morning people at Scorpio, but we're going to give it a go. And then that weekend, Saturday 27th of September, we are selling off-site for Laura Borrowdale's book launch, Dead Ends. Dead Ends is her new collection of short stories, and this launch is going to be a special one. It's going to be quite dynamic, a little bit theatrical. There will be actors involved. I'm in a writing group with Laura. I rate everything she writes. It's always a wee bit freaky and grisly, but we like that. Anyone out there enjoying the Book of Guilt will probably also enjoy Dead Ends. Right, racing along. We're going to be doing the library event Foraging New Zealand by Peter Langlands. Peter's going to be talking at the library on 30th of September about his fantastic Foraging New Zealand book with Rob Cruikshank. And then the next night, the event's sold out, but I'll mention it because I think it's worth highlighting. Everything But the Medicine by Lucy O'Hagan. You might have heard a bit about this memoir. She's a central...
Marianne's done an interview with her.
Yeah. Yes. So, and we're already... It's already flying off the shelves, but she's doing a show in Christchurch. You can join the waitlist if you really, really want to try and get in for Everything But the Medicine at Lumiere on Wednesday, the 1st of October. Now, the week after that, things start to really kick into gear. On the 8th of October, Wednesday night, we are launching Eddie Sparkle's Bridal Taxi by Frankie McMillan.
Can I put a plug in for Frankie? I'm a huge fan. She worked with me at Hagley Writers Institute. She writes the funniest, the most perceptive, the most quirky flash and poems that you could come across. And I'm just delighted to see she's got a new collection coming out.
And it looks to be fabulous. We're going to be shelving it in poetry, but I believe it is. It's flash and fiction and poems. The next night, Thursday 9th of October, we launch Fire Stations of Aotearoa New Zealand by George Lockyer. George Lockyer, he's a regular in the transport section at Scorpio. We sell Kiwi sheds, and he also writes books about motorbiking across New Zealand. We're really looking forward to this event. George is going to bring in some firefighters to talk to the crowd.
He comes from Governor's Bay.
He does.
And then, can I tell you a fun fact?
Go, yeah.
Mel Dixon is also a firefighter in Governor's Bay.
You're dead right. I remember her saying that. Yes. The local scene, interdisciplinary.
Yes, you know? Absolutely.
And then Friday the 10th, you'll be hearing more about this book very soon, I believe, The Food Farm by Angela Clifford and Nick Gill. We will be launching this in store on Friday the 10th of October. It's a wonderful book. It's about growing food. It's about eating food. It's got recipes. It's got gardening tips. It's got a wee planting diary in there. And Angela and Nick are going to be providing some fare, which will be exciting, some produce. The next day, Saturday, 11th of October, it's like Christmas, it's like a birthday, it's bookshop day. So if anyone's been to a bookshop day at Scorpio before, you'll know that we get a little bit excited in the shop, we get a bit silly, we're gonna dress it up, we are gonna be in costumes, and members of the public, you're more than welcome to attend bookshop day also dressed up in literary costume. There'll be giveaways, there'll be spot prizes. We are doing a big book stack giveaway, so every purchase in store on bookshop day gets you an entry form to go in to win. There's also going to be the Love Your Bookshop postcard, what do we call it, competition with Booksellers Aotearoa New Zealand. So basically you write a love letter to your favourite bookshop and you get to go in the draw to win stacks of Booksellers tokens. We're doing blind date with a BWB text. So these little BWB books, the little white ones, they're going to be wrapped up with a few bits of their sort of biography written on them, and then you can pick one at random for the price of $10 and get to go home with your very own, perfect match, hopefully. Lots of spot prizes if you come in dressed up. And we're also going to be hiding a Libro FM golden ticket somewhere in the bookshop for one lucky customer to find. If you don't know about Libro FM, this is a B Corp. This organisation teams up with independent bookshops to provide like an audiobook selling service. So you sign up to Libro FM, you pick the local bookshop that you want to support, and every time you buy an audiobook, a little bit of that money goes to that bookshop. So you can support your audiobook addiction whilst also supporting your bricks and mortar bookstore. And this golden ticket is going to be very exciting. There'll be the golden ticket equals 12 credits, so essentially a year's worth of audiobooks. We're also doing loyalty card amnesty, and the personal penguins are coming back. So buy two penguin books and get a personal penguin, a little figurine. And at 3 p.m. on Saturday 11th of October, we're going to have a couple of our favourite local authors reading. So you could come in at 3 p.m. You can hear from Jeffrey Buchanan, who recently published a book which won the Michael Gifkins Prize with text publishing. And you can hear from Laura Borrowdale of Dead Ends, who I mentioned just before, and Tina Makariti, which will be grand. Tuesday, 14th of October, we will be hosting Tina Makariti in store for an author talk with Isla Huia, both beloved authors for our staff. We were a big fan of the Myers. We're a big fan of This Compulsion and Us, her essay collection from this year, and Isla Huia's book, Talia, we love to bits. It's a mainstay in our New Zealand poetry section. So come in on Tuesday, the 14th of October to hear them doing an author talk together. And then something a bit different, something a bit special, we're going to have a double book launch on Friday 17th of October with Vanessa Croft and Peter Ryan. Vanessa Croft is a novelist. She's releasing Where in All the World, a sort of adventure novel, which takes its main character, Harriet, sort of here and there between New Zealand and Africa. And Vanessa's partner, Peter Ryan, writes essays about hunting. So he's a regular in Wilderness Mag and Hunting Life and other places. And he has written a book of essays called Riding the Echo Down. So we thought we'd do a little double. And they've organised giveaways and prizes. It's going to be an author talk and a book launch. They're going to interview each other. We're excited to see how that goes. Yeah.
Well done. I think you've done a remarkable job. As you say, there's something for absolutely everyone there. You couldn't have more fun than going to Scorpio on Bookshop Day and hanging around there and seeing if you can get a spot prize or whatever. But just go there, look at their books, talk to their very knowledgeable staff, and just enjoy reading. And join us, Marianne Stone and Maureen Rath, on Bookends, sponsored by Scorpio Books, next Tuesday on Plains Media.